Let's call the meeting of government operations to order. We have a quorum? We have a quorum, okay. And we'll start out with, quorums being present. We'll start with last Wednesday when we did my bill, House File 152. Afterwards, during the discussion, I said that if it was asked for by transportation that we'd send it there. Well, I was told right after that when we went to the floor that transportation needs to see it. So we need to, I'm going to hand the gavel to Vice Chair Freiberg, and we'll do the appropriate motions to get it sent to Transportation Finance.
I'll recognize Representative Nelson.
And I move to reconsider the motion on House File 152 that was recommended to pass and be placed on the General Register.
I understand this is a non-debatable motion. Could all in favor please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Representative Nelson withdraws the motion to recommend House File 152 to pass and be placed on the General Register. There is no vote needed on that. Representative Nelson moves to recommend House File 152 to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Transportation Finance. Any discussion? Could all in favor please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries.
And with that, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the minutes would be accurate as to what had occurred at the last meeting, so I would move those minutes to get those done.
Motion has been made to approve the minutes as distributed. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion passes. And with that, then we have House File 414 is on the register. Representative Hornstein. And Representative Hornstein, I'll move your bill. We have it before us, and motion is to place it on the General Register. Is that correct?
Yes. I hope so.
Thank you, Chair Hornstein. We're sending another bill your way.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members, and I really do appreciate your hearing House File 414. So this is an effort that you'll hear more about later in terms of its national implications. This is going on in state legislators and city governments around the country. And really, it's an effort to call attention to the fact that we have a number of communities in our country that have victims of genocide, and we have, of course, the broader discussion about the importance of preventing genocide in the future. So I wanted to talk really briefly, even personally, about why I'm engaged in this. But one question I think has come up is why April? And of course, and we talk about 20th century examples of genocide in our history. April is the month that the Armenian genocide that Representative Banyan talked about on the floor last year started. April was the month that there were several important, very, very disgusting laws that were passed in the Nazi regime in the 30s took place in the month of April that led, of course, to the Holocaust. There's also April was a month that was very pivotal in the Cambodian genocide, the Khmer Rouge, Rwanda, Darfur. It's somehow April was a very decisive month in terms of all of these different genocides that we remember in unfortunately recurring sequence in the 20th century. But before we bring up our testifiers, I just wanted to briefly share with the committee something personal that I don't talk about very often, but one of the reasons this resonates with me is that my parents are survivors of the Nazi Holocaust. And so, this is an issue that, of course, I've grown up with. My dad lost his parents, his sister, his brother. My mom lost everybody, both of her parents, her brothers, was the only survivor in her family. She's from Poland. My mom's from Poland. My dad is from Hungary. So it's always been very important to our family that the Holocaust be honored and remembered. And, of course, you know, in this country, we're so grateful that so many different institutions, churches, people in the interfaith community have made Holocaust education such an important part of the curriculum. You know, the fact that we have a museum on the Mall in Washington, and I don't know how many of you have visited that before, but if you haven't, I'd recommend it on your next trip to Washington, D.C. This country has been incredible, and of course I remember, you know, I have memories of my dad. My parents came to this country as refugees, penniless.
Yes.
They had nothing but their medical education that the American government helped them with in Heidelberg, Germany, which was part of the American zone after World War II. And so, you know, I always am fascinated with the American traditions that immigrants take on. And so one for my dad was always flying the flag on July 4th. We had a big flag. He kept it in our home. But he always, on July 4th, wanted to fly it. And I think that was his way of saying, you know, thank you to the United States. But, you know, it's not this way around the world. We have Holocaust denial still, unfortunately, a part of the political agenda in many countries. You know, Iran has an entire conference dedicated to Holocaust denial. It's part and parcel of, you know, the rhetoric in some groups, even in the United States, some groups on the fringe still promote the fact that it doesn't exist. You know, Hamas, it's part of, you know, Israel's enemies, I think it's part of the culture there, which is, you know, to deny that the Holocaust or talk about it as some sort of a Zionist conspiracy. But I'll conclude, members, with something going back to our country again that's happening that's quite disturbing to me. And it takes place in our political culture, and it takes place right here in the legislature. It's not so much Holocaust denial, it's the trivialization of the event. And what I mean by that, Mr. Chairman and members, is that it seems that in our political discourse in this country that if you don't like somebody, you don't like something that somebody's doing, you call them a Nazi. You don't like what an organization's doing, you say that they resemble the Gestapo. And what that does, and I don't know if there's a term for it, but I call it Holocaust trivialization. You know, and what that does is it kind of demeans, you know, the historical event. It demeans the memory of, you know, my parents, the 6 million that were lost, the 5 million others that were lost to the Nazis. And we have to be very careful, because the second thing it does is that I think it distorts our political discourse to the point where if you call someone a Nazi, even in a flippant way, what you're communicating to that person is that there's no chance for dialogue with you. What you are doing is similar to what the Nazi government did and the Nazi regime did. So you're a murderer, you're a killer, you tolerate this, whatever the implication is. And that, of course, closes off any door for dialogue, any door for discussion. Because what you're saying to somebody is you're a killer. You're someone that tolerates genocide. And so just a couple quick examples before I conclude. A few years ago on the House floor, we had a debate about smoking. Of course, very emotional debate. There's some legitimate issues on both sides. You know, of course, the people that argued against the ban on smoking in restaurants had, you know, some legitimate issues that they wanted to bring to the table. But two different members who are no longer here, one a Democrat, one a Republican. This trivialization of the Holocaust, by the way, members, in politics is bipartisan, just as those of you who have embraced this issue and remembering it in its proper context is bipartisan. We had one member that said, you know, this is what happened in Nazi Germany. So Minnesota is kind of like Nazi Germany in the 30s if we ban smoking in restaurants. And then another member basically said the same thing. And so a year and a half ago, I was able to go to Auschwitz for the first time. And Auschwitz is the site where my grandmother and aunt were killed. And I was taking a tour. There was a young Polish woman in her late 20s who grew up in the town of Oświęcim in Poland, not Jewish. And she made it her life's work to remember what happened in her community. And so I told her the story of what happened on the House floor in the smoking debate. She looked at me, Then she went like this, her palms pointed skyward, and she said, "You know what? I guess those people think what happened here isn't all that important." And so I tell that story because we never want to communicate that what happened isn't all that important. And that's unfortunately what the trivialization of the Holocaust does. I don't know how many, if there's anyone, I don't recognize anyone who was on the Legislative Commission on Metropolitan Governance, but just a few months ago, again, legitimate concerns of business owners on the Central Corridor. I don't deny that in terms of how the light rail may have disrupted their business. But one guy came up and said, "You know, they're putting up concentration camp fencing around my business." He later apologized to me, which I really appreciated. I called him on it, I hopefully in a gentle way. But think about how often you hear this in our modern political discourse. And I hope that when we talk about genocide awareness, we're also talking about the awareness of our political discourse and our language and what it means and the message that it sends. So that's why I'm carrying this legislation. I think it's very important that we as a state all get behind this effort. As the survivors of the Holocaust and other genocides, by the way, this is not just the Holocaust. As I mentioned, there are several others in the 20th century and even 21st century that we have to honor and remember. But as that generation of survivors dies off, and unfortunately my parents have both passed away, my uncles have passed away. One uncle who's a Auschwitz survivor who lives in California that's still alive, but he's in his late 80s. As this generation dies off, it becomes even more critical, even more important that we remember and honor this event so that it never, ever happens again. And so with that, members, I will call up Dr. Kennedy, and she will introduce herself and her organization and the work that is being done at William Mitchell Law School on this issue.
Ms. Kennedy, come forward, and I understand you have somebody else with you. Why don't you both come forward and introduce yourself for the tape. Welcome, Ms. Kennedy, and introduce yourself for the tape and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, guests. My name is Ellen Kennedy. I am the executive director of World Without Genocide, a human rights organization located at William Mitchell College of Law. My colleague is Professor Fred Amram, emeritus professor from the University of Minnesota and a Holocaust survivor. Thank you for the opportunity to be with you this morning to talk about House File 414, the bill to designate April as Genocide Awareness and Prevention Month. I'll give some background, and then we will hear testimonies of three survivors. Professor Amram and I will, of course, welcome your questions at any time. I want to begin by saying that the word genocide did not exist before the Holocaust. A young Polish Jew, a lawyer and jurist named Raphael Lemkin, came to the United States, fleeing from the Nazis. He tried desperately to bring his family here to safety, but 49 members of his extended family perished in the ovens at Auschwitz. Raphael Lemkin felt that there had to be a name to describe the killing of a people. Note that I said of a people, not people, for which we have such words as homicide, fratricide, but the killing of a group of people based solely on who they are. He coined that term genocide. Geno, a Greek root meaning people or tribe or group, and side from the Latin meaning killing. Once he had the word, he felt that there had to be a law to prevent and to punish that crime. And Raphael Lemkin wrote the Genocide Convention. It was ratified by the United Nations in 1948. This convention defines genocide as the attempt to exterminate in whole or in part a racial, ethnic, religious, or national group. Now, you know that in order for a United Nations resolution or a convention to become the law of our land, it has to be ratified by 67 members of the U.S. Senate. Senator William Proxmire from our neighboring state of Wisconsin was asked if he would get that convention ratified. He thought that would be a very simple task. Senator Proxmire gave 3,211 speeches on the floor of the Senate, a speech a day for 19 years before our U.S. Senate finally ratified that convention. When it was ratified, it became known on the Hill as Proxmire's convention. 2 years ago, we from World Without Genocide hand-delivered more than 800 letters to Minnesota senators and representatives from nearly every district throughout the state, urging them to support a bill identical to the one we are considering today. A dozen organizations highlighted in a letter in your packets representing faith and other groups joined with us. The result was that a resolution to which Representative Hornstein has referred was unanimously passed in both the House and the Senate, a resolution declaring April 2011 to be Genocide Awareness and Prevention Month. In April 2012, we received a certificate of recognition from Governor Dayton, recognizing our efforts to educate the public about genocide and to commemorate the victims. Today, we hope to make this recognition permanent through passage of this bill. This is our Proxmire moment. If we don't do this now, people will look back and wonder, why didn't we do it? Why didn't we do it then? After the Holocaust, the world said never again. Never again would people sit idly by while millions of innocent people are exterminated based solely on who they are. Yet these words have come to mean over and over again. After the Holocaust, genocide happened in Cambodia in the 1970s, killing one out of every four of the people in that country. In 1994, in a genocide in Rwanda, 800,000 people were killed in 100 days. In Bosnia, in the 1990s, 200,000 people perished. A genocide back in Europe, 50 years after the Holocaust. In 2003, genocide broke out in the Darfur region of Sudan, a conflict that continues today, with an estimated 400,000 people dead and millions displaced. In 2008, the Genocide Prevention Task Force was convened by the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum, to which Representative Hornstein alluded, the American Academy of Diplomacy, and the United States Institute of Peace. This august task force was chaired by Madeleine Albright and William Cohn, former Secretary of Defense. Their report outlined critical steps to take to prevent future genocides. One of these prevention measures is what brings us here today. That prevention measure is to educate the public. Today's bill is based on similar legislation passed by two other states in the U.S. Only two, California in 2010 and Texas in 2011. Georgia passed a resolution in 2012, and they are hearing that resolution again in bill form this month, as we are. This legislation at the state level indicates that these states recognize the importance of holding events to honor survivors, to inform about genocides past and present, and to engage ordinary citizens in supporting efforts for peace and justice. Minnesota has welcomed refugees from the world's worst conflicts. We are home to descendants of the genocide of the Armenians during World War I, to Holocaust survivors, their children, like Representative Hornstein, and their grandchildren, and communities of those who have fled from the horrors in Cambodia, Bosnia, Rwanda, Darfur, Congo, Somalia, Burma, and elsewhere. The list is long. We have chosen April for this important designation, like these other three states have done, because it is the month in which the anniversaries of many of these tragedies occur. April 3rd, the Darfur genocide. April 5th, the anniversary of the siege of Sarajevo, Bosnia. April 7th, Rwandan Genocide Remembrance Day. April 8th, Holocaust Remembrance Day. April 17th, the anniversary of the Cambodian Genocide. And April 24th, Armenian Genocide Remembrance Day. The state of Minnesota has a history of standing up against genocide. In 2007, Governor Pawlenty signed into law a bill that divested our state public pension fund from companies that directly or indirectly were funding the genocide in Darfur. Minnesotans did not want their tax dollars to be complicit with that genocide. To date, 29 other states in the United States have divested. Minnesota was one of the earliest to do so. Seven cities then followed our state's lead. More cities than in any other state. Minneapolis, St. Paul, Edina, Virginia, Red Wing, Winona, and Hopkins. All of you undoubtedly have refugees in your districts, people whose stories we don't truly know or understand, people who are reticent, as Representative Hornstein has been, to share their personal stories. This bill honors their histories and reminds us that the global becomes the local, that the issues throughout the world ultimately affect us here in Minnesota. At World Without Genocide, we believe that all people must become what we call upstanders, people who stand up in the face of difficult human rights and moral choices. We ask all of you today to become upstanders and to support this measure, a simple first step towards genocide prevention. Your folders have information about the bill, about our programs, and a book about four of the recent genocides to which I have alluded, a book written by law students. Some of these students are here today. They have committed to a future of advocacy for human rights, and perhaps someday they will take some of the seats around this room. There are three survivors who will share some words, one of them here in person. And it's my honor to introduce Fred Amram, Emeritus Professor at the University of Minnesota and Holocaust survivor.
Thank you, and welcome to the committee, Mr. Amram. And could you please state your name for the tape and spell it so we have it properly in the minutes?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Fred Amram, A-M-R-A-M. I want to tell you just a little bit about my life story. On January 30th, 1933, Hitler became Chancellor of Germany. Only 2 months later, in March of 1933, Dachau opened its gates as the first concentration camp. In April of 1933, Hitler requested a boycott of all Jewish-owned shops. In September, just 8 months after Hitler became chancellor, a Jewish baby was born in a Catholic infant's home. I was that baby. Why would I, a Jewish baby, be born in a Catholic infant's home? Because already, only 8 months after Hitler became chancellor, healthcare was inadequate, unavailable for Jewish women, for Jews. There was one order of nuns that were upstanders, that were ready to stand up, take a risk, and they accepted Jewish women in their home. Things got worse. In April of 1935, the Nuremberg Laws passed. The Nuremberg Laws said that all Jews will lose their civil rights. Jews could no longer become teachers. Jews could no longer work in the civil service. Where was everybody? Where was the world? The world knew what was happening, but somehow they weren't involved. In 1937, my mother walked me to the park at the corner of our street in Hanover, Germany. And on this particular day, we found one bench, just one, that said, Nur für Juden, only for Jews. As a little boy, I thought that was pretty cool. A bench just for me. But the next week when we went to the park, all the other benches said, Nur für Arier, only for Aryans. And those were the good days, because there came the time when we had no benches. It was after that that the Gestapo came to our house with guns drawn, and they invaded our home. They took my father's business, lock, stock, and barrel. In 1938, the German army marched into Austria. It was the Anschluss. Barely a shot was fired. Where was everybody? Where was the world? This was public knowledge. It had even become an international crisis. On November 8, 1938, we witnessed Kristallnacht, Kristallnacht, the night of broken glass, the night when all the synagogues in Germany and now Austria were burned. Shortly after that, my father was taken into slave labor. Where was everybody? I want to say, where were you? But of course, you weren't born yet. But your parents were. The world was watching Benny Goodman play at Carnegie Hall. Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs had just opened. And we were having totally different experiences. If the world had interceded, I would not have become a refugee in a new land with a new language. I have a friend who lives in Golden Valley, Marilla Newman. I helped her write a book about her experiences, and we have one chapter about Auschwitz where she talks about how she and her inmates looked up at the sky in the winter between 1943 and 1944. Looked up at the sky and said, where is everybody? Where are the airplanes? Why aren't they bombing us? What's happening? Does anybody know we're here? Other than my wife and my children, I have no relatives. My cousins and my uncles and my aunts have all been left in Germany, in the gas chambers and the crematoria and the slave labor camps and the ghettos. My relatives are the 6 million. One last story, one last experience, something that happened to me right here on the steps of the state capitol. I was persuaded to go to a rally about genocide 3 or 4 years ago. And I listened to the speeches, and the last of the speeches was Alice Musabende. Alice began very quietly. She talked about how when she was 14, her mother had sent her on an errand. And when she returned, this was in Rwanda, when she returned, she found her grandparents dead. Her parents dead. Her sister, age 12, dead. Her brothers, 9 and 2, dead. And Alice, speaking about Rwanda, became more and more dramatic. And she finally ended with clenching her fist. She ended with, "Never again. Never again," she shouted. And at first I became angry because I said to myself, that's the Jewish slogan. That's the Holocaust slogan. That's our mantra. And then I started to cry because I realized that Alice was my sister. That we share being child survivors. We share genocide, as do my brothers and sisters from Darfur and Armenia and all the other genocides. At no expense, every Minnesota representative can say, I care. Can say, I want to remember the Holocaust and the other genocides. Can say, I want to do my bit to help prevent future genocides. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I want today to create a miracle. The miracle of never again.
I would now like to share words from Sara Bezhanyan. Ms. Bezhanyan is not able to be with us today. She is a descendant of survivors of the Armenian Genocide and asked me to read her words to you. To whom it may concern, my grandparents survived the Armenian Genocide perpetrated by the Turks of the Ottoman Empire during the years of 1915 to 1923. They survived by fleeing the city of Kars, now in modern Turkey, and relocating to the city of Gumri, now in the Republic of Armenia. My great-grandfather had arranged to move his family to safety, and he accompanied them on their journey. He then returned to their ancestral home in Kars to retrieve the last of their belongings. On his way back to his family and to safety, he was stopped by Turkish gendarmes, robbed, and brutally beaten nearly to death. Eventually, he returned to his family and was miraculously nursed back to health. This is one of the heart-wrenching stories I grew up listening to, as told by my grandmother. As sad as this story is, 1.5 million Armenians did not survive to tell theirs. My grandmother would never have imagined that I would recall these stories here in Minnesota, where I emigrated 18 years ago from Armenia and now work as a Spanish teacher in Lanesboro, Minnesota. It is also hard to imagine that a conflict that happened so long ago and so far away still affects Minnesotans today. I think about my grandmother's stories every day and the genocide that nearly eliminated my people. I think I can speak for the Armenians when I say that we would like the return of our lost family, our lost homeland, our lost culture. But mostly we want recognition and remembrance for an event that lives with us to this day. Recognition because this event is a defining event of our existence. And remembrance because the last victim of genocide is the truth. Please adopt a resolution to proclaim April as Genocide Awareness and Prevention Month. Zara Bezhanya. The final words are from Bunkeen Chun. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Bunkeen Chun. I'm a mathematics teacher at Roosevelt High School, Minneapolis School District. I can't be here with you this morning. I'm one of genocide survivors from Cambodia. I was born in the Prasat province, northwestern part of Cambodia. I was the youngest of five children. My father died when my mother was pregnant with me. Nobody in my family had gone to college, so it was important for me to go. My siblings provided whatever financial assistance they could muster to help pay for my education. I was their last hope of becoming a doctor. I went to study in Phnom Penh. Although the Vietnam War carried on to the east, life for the most part wasn't all that bad. Like many other students, I had a part-time job as a pedicab driver in the city, working nights and weekends. Phnom Penh at that time had an invigorating charm to it. In a time where war surrounded Cambodia, it was easy to appreciate the peacefulness of the city. Shortly after starting school, I heard horrific stories of thousands of innocent Cambodians being killed in the countryside. Spillover from the Vietnam War was inevitable. Cambodia felt pressured by both sides of the war, the United States and North Vietnam, but refused to get involved. Then in 1970, the war began. The war was between the Khmer Republic and Viet Cong aggressors. Later, the war shifted to fight against the Khmer Rouge as they gained their strength. Within the next 2 to 3 years, Phnom Penh's population sharply increased from 500,000 to 2 million. The city was the only place these people could flee to escape the war. Many lost farming land and many lost loved ones. They came to Phnom Penh with anything they could carry with them. Most people had to start over and try to raise their families in an already crowded city. After that war ended, the Khmer Rouge took control on April 17, 1975. After taking the city of Phnom Penh, the Khmer Rouge forced the evacuation of 2 million residents to the countryside on foot. Because it was so crowded, it took people maybe a week to get out of the city. Just imagine with me now, we all walk. Now you are walking in the hot sun with your sandals. After walking a long time, your sandals break. You start walking barefoot. Your feet are blistered. The road burns your soles as you continue walking. You also carry some load, and it gets heavier and heavier. April is the driest and hottest month of the year, and drinking water is limited. Some women are carrying babies in their arms. Children are crying as they trudge along with their parents, and even they are carrying something. On the side of the road, the Khmer Rouge punished those who slowed down. I could hear a child asking his parents, "When do we go back home, Papa?" And I could see his parents' faces, speechless, not knowing when they were going to stop. The healthy became weaker and weaker. The sick people could not endure the torturous walk any longer, and many collapsed and died along the road. I witnessed a man holding his mother's dying body in his arms. His pregnant wife and young child stood nearby sobbing. He cried for help, but there was nothing that could have been done. That was only one of the many tragedies that occurred during this march of death. 3 weeks of this, and we reached a place the Khmer Rouge told us was our destination. There we were told to start a new life. First, they dehumanized us. Our hard labor work seemed never end. Our ration is almost nothing. We ate bamboo shoots, cooked by boiling with green leaves, anything. We ate in the morning and ate at night to conserve rations. If we could, we'd mix our food with a little bit of rice. It was tough, overworked, and there was so little food to eat. Some people fell down and died along a road. Sometimes the Khmer Rouge had no rations for us at all, and we were stuck finding food on our own. people disappeared at night. One day I was granted permission to go to another village about 30 kilometers away by bike. But something strange happened when I was away. Former government workers, military personnel, teachers, and civil servants had a chance to go back to Phnom Penh to rebuild their country's infrastructure. They were given an opportunity to start their lives again. They were told they didn't have to work in the fields. I was very upset. If I had been there, I might have volunteered to go with them too. They were all lied to. Instead, the Khmer Rouge put these people on a truck and murdered them in a forest, one person at a time. News spread quickly of this deceptive promise. This regime killed almost 2 million innocent people, including children. I went back to Cambodia in 1993. My sister-in-law showed me a family picture taken in 1972. In that picture, there were my three brothers, my only sister, my mother, and I. All of them but me were killed during the Khmer Rouge regime. Man-made genocide like this is primed to happen again. Please help us to prevent it from happening again. Thank you for your attention. Bong Kin Chun. Senator Proxmire said that the most lethal pair of foes to human rights are ignorance and indifference. This proposed legislation encourages the opposite. It encourages education and action. The moral arc of the universe is long, but it bends towards justice, said Martin Luther King Jr. We can help bend that moral arc. Thank you.
Representative Pepin, you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks to everyone who testified. Wow, that was really, really compelling testimony, and it just breaks your heart to hear the stories. And we certainly never want to forget this, and I appreciate what you're doing with this bill. I do have a couple of questions for Representative Hornstein, though. Representative Hornstein, as we know, sometimes in an attempt to do to make a good bill, there are some unintended consequences. And between lines 118 and 124, I have some questions, definitional questions, that just kind of, if you could go over some of the words and maybe talk about what you had in mind, because I want to make sure that the words have meaning, and we all know what those words mean. On line 118, you talk about mass atrocities and effective prevention measures, and then crisis. And so I just want to, since there are other things going on, like controversial gun bills, I want to understand more about what those words mean. What's the definition of a mass atrocity? So, for example, would the school shooting in Sandy Hook be a mass atrocity? Ineffective prevention measures, what might that look like? I'm wondering, the reason I ask is because I'm wondering if we could clarify those more in the language so that this otherwise non-controversial bill would be non-controversial.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, Representative Pepin, absolutely essential and critical question. And I have some thoughts about that, and I'd like Dr. Kennedy to also respond. But you have hit the nail on the head in terms of why genocide is different from the kinds of things that you were describing. And I think that, you know, part of, again, this issue that I've described before about trivializing these events, I think sometimes, and if we can figure out the definitions to make it clear, I'm really willing to work with you and anyone else on this. But I think genocide is just a category all unto itself. Mm-hmm. And I'll never forget, I actually did I did collect my parents' survival stories and relative stories in a oral history I did in college. And I was kind of researching what different people said about the Holocaust, historians and others. And there was a guy at Hebrew University in Jerusalem named Yehuda Bauer. And he said something, you know, very much along the lines, I think, where you're going, Representative Pepin. He said, you know, when every example of, you know, awful things that happen in the world that we know and that we acknowledge that you had referenced. But when all of these all of a sudden become genocide, then we again minimize and trivialize what actually happened. And so the events in the 20th century that we referred to, you know, are in a category all unto themselves. And whether we need to actually make those explicit in the bill, that might be something to sort of get to what you're after, and I think what we're after, so that there's absolutely no confusion, that we're being very clear about what genocide is and the events that we intend to commemorate. I don't know if Dr. Kennedy has something that she wants to add.
Ms. Kennedy.
Along a similar line with what Representative Hornstein is saying, that's why this bill refers to the definition of genocide, so that the kinds of atrocities that are being referenced are those definitional crimes that begin with line 111 and extend down through 117. So the very definition to which I referred, created by Raphael Lemkin in the United Nations Convention, these are the kinds of mass atrocities to which we are making reference. Deliberately, with the intent to exterminate people based on their membership in a national, ethnic, racial, or religious group. I think that definition preceding line 118 clarifies it.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Kennedy, and Representative Hornstein. I see where you're going with this, but usually in legislation we have more specific definitions, and I think, and I do worry that mass atrocities could mean a school shooting, and I just want to give you a little bit about my kind of fear of this language that I'm not, that makes me not as comfortable. We're making it's intent language. The state declares that to prevent future genocides, which I think that definition is pretty clear, but I think that mass atrocities isn't as clear. So I think that when you talk about mass atrocities, I worry that if there were some school shooting or something, the governor then, from my reading, could take effective preventive measures. Now, I don't know what that means. That might mean gun control measures. It might be completely off of the charts as to what you're trying to accomplish with this bill. And I think unless there are some definitional measures in here, I think it's going to be difficult to really hone in on what you're trying to do. I think it's going to be kind of the lines 1.6 through 1.17 are going to be overshadowed by this other part, because the other definitional issue would be crisis, before a crisis has erupted. Again, crisis could be some type of shooting or some other type of event that has nothing to do with genocide. And then the line, the governor may take any action necessary to promote and encourage the observance of Genocide Awareness and Prevention Month. Again, I don't know what any action could be. Any action could be banning guns, perhaps. So I'm not trying to be difficult, but I just feel like that one lines 1.18 through 1.24 need a little bit of work so that it doesn't get sidetracked in these other issues that have nothing to do with genocide awareness or what you're trying to do. And I'm wondering if you'd consider working on that part.
So, Chair Hornstein.
Mr. Chair and Representative Pepin, I, again, so appreciate how you have read this carefully and some of your thoughts and ideas. And, you know, this is something that I feel that we can work on so that there's no ambiguity, and that and I would be willing to work with you and anyone else on the committee to tailor the language so that we get at what we're really trying to get to, and that there's no cause for concern. And you know, Mr. Chairman, you know, in terms of the motion that's before us, and our new, which I agree with, our new modus operandi in the legislature, I hope, which is to not do amendments on the fly and wordsmith in committee. You know, we'll have our discussion, and I'd like to hear more comments and thoughts, but I would be willing to work with Representative Pepin and anyone else to get this language right so that there's no concern and this doesn't become some kind of a vehicle for debates on other issues that are on people's minds. It's very simple. It's very straightforward. It's bipartisan. It's something we can work on together. And so for that reason, you know, maybe we can modify the motion and you just hold the bill in committee, and then I'd be willing to work with people just to get this language right so that we're not mixing up issues. And that we, once we get to the floor, it's very clear what we're doing and that we can have 134 green votes.
Representative Pepin?
Mr. Chair and Representative Pornstein, I think that'd be a great idea, just even if it were holding it over for a few days or something to address that language so it doesn't get mixed up in other issues.
And I think that Mr. Chairman, the very phrases that you identified, I think I agree are potentially problematic, and so I think that's why we have the hearing process to unearth this stuff. And so I greatly appreciate your input on this.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I was, you know, through that discussion, it's similar to, you know, the definitions. I didn't hear where, you know, there are tens of millions were killed by Mao and Stalin, and some of those were by in one case it was many of the educated class, you know, which you don't fit into here, you know, and then there are examples in, you know, Idi Amin and other cases where groups which might not fit into that. So those are also considered, genocide underneath this definition?
Again, Representative Bernstein, Dr.
Chair, Representative Quammen, I'm going to have Dr. Kennedy respond to the bulk of your question. But, this is sort of that point that I had referenced earlier that Dr. Bauer was talking about, where, you know, there are all sorts of just horrific things that have happened in human history, as you have alluded to. But there is a little bit of a difference between that and what we're talking about here, and I'll have Dr. Kennedy elaborate.
Dr. Kennedy.
Thank you. There are many scholars who have addressed this issue of what kinds of conflicts fall under that definition of genocide, and many of them wish to include political efforts to exterminate people who are of other political persuasions. The Genocide Convention was crafted during the period of the Cold War, and of course one of the big players at the United Nations was the Soviet Union. Political party affiliation had originally been included in the definition of genocide along with racial and other categories, and because of the influence of the Soviet Union, that term was taken out. So there are many scholars who would include the conflicts that you just mentioned. There has been an effort on the part of scholars, particularly in the last decade, to broaden that definition. So it's a controversial issue academically. What we are really hoping to do is encourage efforts to memorialize groups who have been targeted in horrific ways simply because of who they are, innocent people who have been persecuted based on their identities. And thank you for raising that very, very difficult point.
And Representative Hornstein and Ms. Kennedy, just like the bill says, awareness, the discussion here has brought up awareness of other things that aren't in the bill. Representative Kahn.
I just wanted to point out to partial answer to Representative Pepin is that the take action that we're talking about is to promote and encourage the observance of Genocide Awareness and Prevention Month. And I think that's that's very different than the governor taking action if we were as unfortunate as other places to have a school shooting. Well, we did have an outrageous shooting event in Minnesota, in Minneapolis. But I don't see how this language would empower the governor. That was clearly not a genocide issue, but I don't see how this action, how this language gives us any fear of the governor taking extreme positions of some kind, particularly listening to the governor's comments.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hornstein, thank you for your work on this and the others that you have brought to testify on it. One of the things that I think that could happen on this is that we, well, let me step back. I appreciate your willingness to work to craft this so that this doesn't get co-opted, trivialized, or misappropriated in what its intent is. And as Representative Kahn said, the governor's comments, that's the current governor. We want this to go into perpetuity, and as political forces change, as interests change, I do not want to have legislation that would, again, trivialize, marginalize the atrocities that you're talking about in here. And so I think it's a good idea, and I support the effort of crafting this so that we can get bipartisan support, that it's a very bright line in the sand as to what the intentions are. So that the memories of the people who we're trying to honor here and the atrocities that we're trying to prevent in the future don't become victims once again to political whims.
And members, we've been joined by the ninth grade students from the Heritage Christian Academy, and welcome to the committee. And with the bill we're discussing here today that we're going to lay over for to get some language worked out on, has to do with creating a Genocide Awareness Month, naming April Genocide Awareness Month in Minnesota. So it's appropriate that you're here and to see what's going on in the committee. And Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you all three for what you're doing and bringing this to our attention and giving us the opportunity to help with that. I have a couple of questions, kind of following along with what Representative Pepin was concerned about. As I was reading lines, especially 115 through 117, what came to my mind was the Native Americans. And I also didn't hear any mention of them and wondered how that can play into this in a really constructive way so that we don't, so that we correct problems and issues and that we move in a very positive direction. The other question that I have as change management and organization development person is the effective prevention measures. I really would love to hear what that might be beyond what the governor might do, but what kinds of things are you thinking about? Thank you.
Ms. Kennedy, if you can be succinct, because we need to get another to another bill, so I'd like to wrap this up, seeing as how we're going to lay it over for to get the language worked out.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee. As I think all of you know, in December and January, the Minneapolis and St. Paul City Councils designated the Dakota War of 1862 as genocide, and we at World Without Genocide approach that conflict the same way, and that certainly would be one of the many genocides historically that would be commemorated. In terms of what ordinary people can do, in terms of what prevention is, as former Secretary of State and United Nations Ambassador Madeleine Albright and former Secretary of Defense Cohn said in that report, the first and most important step is education. And through education, of course, we at William Mitchell College of Law believe that we are able to encourage future lawyers as well as students at other institutions to become involved directly in advocating for human rights so that they are people who are working in both local and national capacities to support and to advance human rights, peace, and justice everywhere. Thank you.
With that, I'm going to lay this bill over, and Representative Pepin and Representative Hornstein, I would hope the two of you get together and work on the language, and if anyone else has language that they would like to work on with Representative Hornstein, get that done so we get this back on and get it passed. And with that, I'm going to lay the bill over.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members. Thank you for your attention to this.
The next bill on our agenda for today is Representative Simonson's bill on tax expenditures, House File 507. And I will move that House File 507 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee of Town Taxes. And before Representative Simonson gets started here, we may have noticed that Representative Lean has joined us in the committee today. Currently, he doesn't have a vote on this committee, but there's going to be some reshuffling due to the two special elections that went on and the two new representatives that were sworn in this morning. And my understanding, I've been informed that Representative Lean is going to join the committee, Representative Ward is going to be stepping off the committee, and there's going to be some couple other changes that will take place sometime next week. I don't know exactly what the effective date is, but that'll be coming up. So you can stay, Representative Lean, and listen and get up to speed, but if we do have a roll call vote or a voice vote, please do not vote. Welcome, Representative Simonson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to the committee for hearing House File 507. I'm assuming that in your packet you also have the A1 amendment. But, Mr. Chair, with your indulgence, I ask that we don't move the amendment just quite yet.
Okay, Representative Simonson, is that your amendment? And
it is my amendment. It is an author's amendment. But I'd like to try to get through some of my comments before we move the amendment, if that's okay.
Fine. And we have till 11:30, so members, we're going to get this bill voted on today, so please be wary of the time. Representative Simonson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 507 actually was a concept that was born in that other body. And I agreed to carry this in the House simply because I think that it's a good idea. I don't bring with me today a number of testifiers either in support, and I don't anticipate any testifiers in opposition to the bill. I think that in my discussions with folks in our body, that it has support on a bipartisan basis, and I think it does make some good sense. But I just want to talk a little bit about the pieces of the bill that would be specific to your committee and try to steer you away from the details of the always exciting tax portion. House File 507 would essentially create a tax expenditure advisory commission whose primary purpose would be to create a systematic and transparent review process defined in statute of tax expenditures by this appointed commission. I personally believe that if this bill were passed into law in some version, that it will create not only a provision for systematic review of the tax expenditure and its current relativity, but would also provide Minnesotans a better opportunity for transparency and involvement in our process. Commission membership, I'll touch on briefly. 12 members. And if you kind of, I'm going to try to stay on the current version of the bill and not bounce too much into the amendment. But current membership or the commission membership would be made up of 12 members, which would include both the Senate and the House Tax Committee chairs, two senators, one from the majority party, one from the minority party, appointed by the Senate rules, and two representatives, one majority, one minority party, appointed by the Speaker of the House. And the remaining members would be appointed by the governor, which cover a variety of areas in the general citizenship. And obviously we want, you know, representatives of working families, nonprofit organization, and then three citizens with at least a basic understanding of state tax law. Terms themselves of the commission members would be 2 years that would expire September 1st of each odd-numbered year. And the members would be removed at the pleasure of the appointing authority. Term limits, there would be term limits on this commission, with the exception of the tax chairs themselves. After 4 years of service, they would no longer be eligible to sit on the commission. Any legislator who would serve a full term may not be appointed to immediately succeeding term, and public members themselves may not serve consecutive terms. However, they also would be eligible to serve a total of 4 years. The chair and the vice chair of the committee may not be from the same membership group. Quorum would equal 7 members of the commission in order to take an action. The staff, be my intent, at least under the amendment, if we discuss the amendment, to be provided by and hired by Legislative Coordinating Commission. But as far as the specific duties of this new commission, before February 1st, the commission would be required to review the information that's scheduled in the bill for that particular tax year, take public testimony, and vote on a recommendation to what to do with each scheduled tax expenditure that is subject to review in that particular year. The commission would then make a report by February 1st of the first year of our session to the Senate and the House tax chairs, and that final report would be made public. And the bill also contains a schedule about which tax expenditures by chapters in statute that would be reviewed by year and then every 10th year thereafter. And I won't go into the specifics of the chapters, but essentially that covers the creation of the commission, the membership of the commission, and I want to talk briefly. Question, Mr. Chair.
Representative Simonson.
I would like to make some comments about the amendment before we move it. Is that possible?
Yes, proceed.
Thank you. The amendment that you see in your packet, the A1, is essentially the exact amendments that were made in the Senate in their committee hearing, and I just ask that they be prepared and put into an amendment form for today's discussion. I don't necessarily agree with everything that's in this particular amendment, and I'd like to speak to that briefly if I could. And if you look at the A1 amendment, specifically on line 1.21, 2.1 through 2.5, where it talks about deleting the term scheduled to expire and inserting subject to review, I think this really takes away from the intent of the bill. It's something that I would like to, you know, have some feedback from your committee on as well, but this is about the only reason that I didn't walk in here and ask that this amendment be moved right away. The rest of the amendment that falls above that deals with how the commission itself is created, and I don't have any problems with that. I think that what the amendment would do in that case would be legislative officials rather than the governor would be appointing legislators to this commission, which I think is a good thing. Commission members would serve at the pleasure of that particular appointing authority, and the LCC would be employing staff rather than the commission itself hiring its own staff. So the only real question I have in terms of whether we move this amendment or not would be with respect to the tax expenditure review versus expiration. So with that, I'd open it up to any questions.
Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll just make a quick overall point and then ask a few questions later if that's okay. But I just wanted to make sure, Representative Simonson, I know the motion was to send this to taxes, and I just want to get your commitment that this bill will eventually get to state government finance since you are creating creating this expenditure or the Tax Expenditure Advisory Commission, that there's compensation and staff and those other things. So I just want to get your commitment that this will go to state government finance, since the motion was to go to taxes first, that it will end up in state government finance.
Representative Simonson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think that is a fine idea, and I certainly support that. And if possible, maybe the reconsideration of a motion would be to send it there first, but I leave that up to the chair.
Representative Simonson, I've been told that taxes has asked for it, so we'll send it there first. They'll have to then refer it back over the other way, and we'll all make sure we coordinate with Representative Murphy and Representative Lestensky that so their timeline so that doesn't it gets by deadlines.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, but point well taken.
Any further questions? Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Representative Simonson, looking at your A1 amendment, I have a thought of offering your amendment and incorporating a change to delete lines 1.21 through 1.25 from the amendment, but offering the rest. And before I make that motion, I thought I'd check with you that would be friendly.
Representative Simonson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Winkler, I would indeed take that as friendly.
Mr. Chair, I offer the A1 amendment move to amend the bill with the A1 amendment, and I would like to incorporate modification of the amendment to drop lines 1.21 through 1.25.
That was Representative Winkler. That was to drop 1.21 to 1.25, otherwise the rest of the amendment. Do we have that, Mr. Shepherd? So you just that's incorporated. So your amendment would be the A1 amendment minus that those provisions.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Representative Drazkowski on the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question, I guess, Mr. Chair, maybe for Representative Simonson or somebody. Lines 1.12 and 1.13 on the amendment say that members can be removed at the pleasure of the appointing authority. I'm just curious as to whether this is commonplace or it's inherently understood that that's the case now when the Speaker of the House or the President of the Senate makes those appointments. Is this redundant language or are we blazing new ground with this part of the amendment? That's my question, Mr. Chair.
Representative Drazkowski, I'll send that question over to Mr. Shepherd, and he can answer the question. I believe it's pretty common language from what I've seen in commissions. Representative Shepherd. Mr. Shepherd.
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, the general structure of this bill was modeled after the Sunset Advisory Commission, and that is the exact language that appears there. The members, both the legislative members and the governor's appointees, can be removed by the appointing authority at the pleasure.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Shepherd.
Any further questions on the amendment? If not, all in favor of the A1 amendment as modified? Oh, Representative Patton.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and I'm just trying to read through this quickly. I'm just trying to figure out if that line 3.24, the tax expenditure, if everything lines up properly, because that word would be in there. Wait, no, that's not it. Word expires. And 3.2. Yeah, on line 3.22, where it says expire. I'm just trying to figure out. I'm trying to work through that part of the amendment. And if somebody could explain exactly what that why it's expiring versus reviewing, and is it consistent throughout?
Representative Winkler.
I just don't have enough time to read it, so if you could just slow it down a little bit and walk me through it here.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin.
Representative Winkler.
I'd be happy to explain it. I know you don't need it slowed down. What the amendment as drafted would do is to eliminate the expiration of the tax expenditures and to just move it to a review process. We're going to admire them rather than sunset them. And so as I have offered this amendment, we are leaving in the expiration of the tax expenditures. We're just changing the way that the board is appointed and we're leaving in the language regarding the Legislative Coordinating Commission. So the expirations remain in Section 8 under my version of this amendment.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So
I think Mr. Shepherd is looking over there like he would like to explain it. Mr. Shepherd?
He removed it from the amendment. So in other words, on 3.22, the original agent. He removed it from the amendment. So in other words, on 3.22, the original agent language stays. So the tax expenditure scheduled to expire during the following biennium. So the tax expenditures will actually expire.
Representative.
That's your intent.
Winkler, Representative Simonson. Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, that is my intention.
Representative Simonson.
And that is my intention as well.
Representative Pepin.
We're just trying to work our way through it. Is it actually they have the power to expire the expenditure or just in the report? I'm confused about that part. Maybe that's a question for Mr.
Chair, Representative Pepin. I think the language that you need to look at in Section 8, it's pretty straightforward. The tax expenditures in the statute as of July 1 are subject to sunset review and expiration on the following schedule. It's not, the language is different, but it's not so different from the current Sunset Commission.
Representative Peppin.
That's good for now.
Any other questions on the amendment? If not, all in favor of the A1 amendment as modified by Representative Winkler, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The ayes have it. The amendment's adopted. Representative Simonson, any further comments that you would like to make now that the amendment's on?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think my comments originally were inclusive of the amendment that was just passed here, so I would just continue further questions if there are any.
Any further questions? Representative Quam, I had you on the list before.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Looking at this, so my understanding is this is to get rid of deductions and exemptions that are in the code now, so taxpayers would see a cleaning house of deductions and exemptions.
Representative Simonson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that is essentially correct. When we talk about tax expenditures to the average taxpayer, they see that as a deduction on their income tax form. So according to the schedule on page 4, starting on line 4.28, on December 31st, 2015, all of the tax expenditures or tax deductions, if you will, in those specific chapters of statute would expire. And those would be the ones that are subject to the review by the commission in that particular year. And then the commission, in turn, would make a recommendation in a report to the tax chairs of the Senate and the House. And it would be the intent that the tax committee then would take action on based on the recommendation by the commission.
Representative Quam.
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Simonson, the process would be a review by this group, a report coming, and then the tax committee would include in a individual or omnibus bill the removal of deductions and exemptions. And then it would proceed through as a normal bill to the floor and would be available for amendment. Because I know there were some reports and stuff that weren't. So this would be just a standard bill with possibly including recommendations?
Representative Simonson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that is mostly correct, with the exception that if the legislature took no action, these provisions would automatically expire. So in order for the legislature to continue that tax expenditure or modify that tax expenditure, it would require an action to be taken, which would be taken through the normal committee process and then off onto the floor.
Representative Quam.
Well, thank you for that clarification, so that this committee could, with its actions and without an approval from a future legislature, take away exemptions and deductions from the citizens. I'll move on to the next question, which has to do with the gifts and grants. And you know, I have some concern, this being on the bottom of page 5, section 11, I have some concerns about the, you know, how the public perception of entities that may be, you know, related to, you know, tax code basically affects everyone in the state, whether, you know, basically everyone. So if you've got a organization and you do a 501c, that you can then do gifts and grants to this committee. I just hit, what is to protect us from review of maybe some perception or actual impropriety? Is would these grants be reviewed by, you know, the Campaign Finance Board, since many of the members would be legislators?
Representative Simonson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Quam, before And I'm going to refer your question on gifts and grants probably to Mr. Shepherd. But before we go there, I do want to correct you on one very important point in the fact that this committee, as we see the bill amended before us, has no authority to do anything statutorily. So they do not have the authority to stop a tax expenditure or expire a tax expenditure. Under the current language as amended here today, those provisions would automatically expire in statute by statute on December 31st of the particular year. And the sole purpose of the commission is to review the expiring expenditures and make recommendation in a report back to the tax chairs in both houses, who then, in theory, would take whatever necessary action that the legislature would want to take through the normal process. So the commission itself has no authority to either create a tax expenditure or to cancel a tax expenditure. They will automatically expire, and it is those expenditures in statute that automatically expire that will be reviewed according to the schedule in the bill. So the commission doesn't have that sort of authority. But with respect to the question on gifts and grants, Mr. Chair, if I could refer that to staff, that would be wonderful.
Mr. Shepherd.
Mr. Chair and Representative Quam, I believe you had asked if the gifts and grants would be subject to the authority of the Board of Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure. And I think they would not be, just because, as I understand this, these gifts would be gifts to the government entity, the commission, and not gifts to the individuals. If they were gifts to individual members, then there would be an issue under Chapter 10A. But as the bill is currently drafted, I don't think it would be an issue under the gift law.
And Mr. Shepherd, is this language similar to language we have elsewhere in statute?
Mr. Chair and members, this is the language that appears in the law governing the Sunset Advisory Commission.
Representative Quam.
Okay. Well, thank you for that clarification. And the clarification from the author indicating that, you know, if we pass this, that, you know, unless action is taken, all of our deductions and exemptions could expire. Are there any that, you know, like the mortgage interest deduction or any areas exempted from that automatic? You know, I'd like to understand, because if we pass this and then we allow a process where all that disappears, you know, without action, I just would like to understand what wouldn't disappear.
Representative Simonson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Quam, and that is really the spirit of the bill, is to create a process where these tax expenditures, which, as you well pointed out, to the general public, what they know as deductions, what this really means is either money in their pockets or money in the state's pocket. And the intent of this bill is to create an open, transparent review process for each expenditure in statute. So there is no tax expenditure that's exempt from this process. Obviously, we spread them out over a 10-year period just because of the amount of detail. But I do believe that every expenditure in our current statute is subject to review, and that was the intent of the bill, to create a process where they would automatically expire, and it does require a tax committee and the legislature of that year to take some appropriate action, whether they want to allow that to expire, whether they want to reinstate it in its current form, or whether they want to modify it going forward. But that is based on input from the commission itself as well as the general committee process.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I'd have an oral amendment to delete Section 10 from the bill. Mr. Chair, the Section 10seems to be a section that is not really necessary. It doesn't do anything in the bill. It doesn't. There's no functional use for Section 10, Mr. Chair, and that's the reason for the oral amendment.
Representative Simonson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Drazkowski. I would like to hear from staff if they're able to comment on what they believe the impact to that would be before
I respond. Mr. Shepherd.
Mr. Chair and members, as the bill is currently drafted, it, as the author and others have indicated, it does provide that tax expenditures do expire unless reenacted. And Section 10 states that the legislature can enact legislation to continue it and doesn't prohibit the legislature from eliminating it earlier. I tend to agree with Representative Drazkowski that this would probably be true even if Section 10 were not in the bill.
Any further questions on this oral amendment? If not, we'll vote on it. All in favor of the oral amendment to remove Section 10, which is lines 5.17 to 5.21 from the bill, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion is approved. The amendment's adopted. Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Simonson, was going to ask a question about public hearings, wondering if there were some, and then I found this in the bill, section subdivision 2, so it's 4.10 in that section following. My question was going to be if there were going to be public hearings for the taxpayers who would be affected by decisions of this commission. And in reading this, I wasn't crystal clear that, in fact, on line 4.12, that taxpayers are being referred to as beneficiaries. And I would like to make an oral amendment that the words "the beneficiaries" be struck and "affected taxpayers" be inserted. I'm wondering if that might be something that you might give consideration to.
Representative Simonson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, I think the term beneficiaries, and again we'll refer to staff to answer this, but I think the term is consistent with language throughout statute, and you know, I totally understand where you're coming from and where you want to go and your point.
Mr. Simons, or Mr. Shepherd.
Mr. Chair, members, I don't have any technical thoughts on this. I think either language could work under this bill. So, the committee.
Representative Simonson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative. Certainly, if that makes the committee more comfortable, I am not opposed to that change.
So, Representative Pugh, can you repeat what your oral amendment is so that we're sure Mr. Shepherd has it down correctly?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. That the words "the beneficiaries" on line 4.12 be struck and replaced with the words "affected taxpayers."
Affected
taxpayers.
Mr. Shepherd, do you have that? Members, any more questions on any questions or comments on that? If not, we'll vote. All in favor of the proposed amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion's approved. The motion's adopted and the amendment's approved. Any further questions? O'Driscoll, Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Simonson, thank you for being with us today. I've just a couple questions about the provision as I was reading this on line 5.9 that talks about the expiration date of the tax expenditure may not exceed 12 years from the date and so forth. My question to you is this. A lot of times businesses and individuals will make investment decisions about capital expansion or capital purchases. One of the things is a tax deduction for depreciation and other capital outlay. My question is, if a business or job provider wants to come to Minnesota or expand, and they make a decision to make an investment, it's a 30 or a 50-year investment, with a 12-year sunset, there's a possibility that the rules may change midstream for that particular business, or does the law provide for, if you were under the old rule, that you'd still be able to be under the old rule? And maybe another way to put that is, when you're halfway across the river, will the tide change on you, and you've got to look at trying to figure out how to deal with that.
Representative O'Driscoll, or Representative Simonson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, I think that's a great point. And again, I think the to be clear about what the intent here is, to create an open and transparent process for an automatic review of each one of our tax expenditures. So with respect to your question, I think that the legislature on any given session really has the ability to change current law, which in theory would change the way that you wanted to cross that river, so to speak. And I don't think that we're making it any worse by doing this. And in fact, I think what we're gaining is an open and transparent process. So it doesn't solve the scenario that you lay out, but at the same time, I think under current statute that, and even under the proposed bill here, the legislature could make these changes on any given year still.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And I'd like to get this voted on here in a couple of minutes here because our committee time, we're past our committee time right now, so.
Because I had some other questions that were kind of in the tax, and maybe I'll just skip that and go to the next one. Yesterday we passed the tax conformity bill, and many of those things that we do in the state of Minnesota are predicated on federal law, deduction of home interest, residents who would have property tax that they would pay would be deductible, and some other kinds of expenditures and different deductions, IRAs and the like. How do you anticipate this no longer conforming or creating issues for tax conformity and causing confusion for taxpayers?
Representative Simonson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, I don't envision that this bill, if passed into law, would create any more additional confusion with respect to federal tax conformity. I think that the two would align very well together. And quite frankly, I think that once we get into this scheduled process, that it will actually work better. But I think that, you know, federal tax conformity, it is what it is, but this really is about the expenditures in our state statute. And, you know, the question is, are they relevant? Do they still work? Are they still meaningful? Are they still needed? Is it necessary? Do we do something different? And rather than continue to have these discussions here at our level, we just want to open it up more to the public and say, okay, here's a commission, here's a process. We want to value your input outside of the committee process and the legislative process. So I don't think it has any impact on federal tax conformity.
Representative O'Driscoll. Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then Representative Simonson, and even more so, I don't know if there's a representative from the Legislative Coordinating Commission here, but I'm curious, I see through the amendment now we've inserted the LCC shall employ an executive director, and then may employ other staff as necessary. So I'm curious if there's anyone here from the LCC, or if you've had any conversations with them. Basically, where are they at on this? Have they do they have experience working and reviewing tax expenditures or dealing with the tax code? Do they have appropriate staff? Maybe how they feel about being mandated to employ an executive director for this. I'm just kind of curious as to how that ended up here in this amendment and where we're at and
Representative
where they're at in that process.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, the reason why it's before you in the amendment is simply to take that workload off of the commission itself. Our commissions are not in the business of hiring staff or employing folks. So with respects to is LCC on board? You know, clearly they are on board. They're not here today, but I think that at any point in time we could bring them in and have them speak to that. But essentially that's what they're here for. And we wanted to take that load off of the commission who is not in the human resources.
Representative Simonson, I see Greg. Mr. Hubinger is here from the LCC.
My apologies.
I didn't see him earlier, so. Mr. Hubinger, please identify yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony. Maybe you can answer the question.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm Greg Hubinger with the Legislative Coordinating Commission. We just briefly reviewed the amendment, and as Mr. Shepard indicated, the language seems similar to the language that was adopted and implemented for the Sunset Advisory Commission. And it is, although we don't have any special expertise on the tax code, we do have expertise in supporting commissions, and with this language, we would go through the process of hiring a staff person or persons to support that commission's work. I'm assuming that This would have a fiscal impact on our office, and that this bill would go to State Government Finance for that review.
Mr. Hubinger, we've already mentioned that it is going to have to go there. Representative Saunders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Hubinger, if there's not a direct appropriation in the State Government Finance Committee, or if it's not paid for, does the LCC have the ability right now to employ an executive director to provide administrative support services and employ other staff as necessary?
Mr. Hubinger.
Mr. Chair, Representative Saunders, we don't have that staff expertise to provide the kind of support. I should say, though, that, for example, with the Sunset Advisory Commission, we did provide a limited amount of support to that commission's work by using staff from House Research and Senate Counsel and Research.
Representative Saunders.
And then just last question, Mr. Chair. Just wondering how much input you had, Mr. Hubinger, if the LCC did in the drafting of this amendment. Were you consulted? Did you ask to be a part of this new commission?
Mr. Hubinger.
Mr. Chair, Representative Saunders, we were not involved.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Hubinger, I believe that the language for the Sunset Commission said that the LCC shall provide staff instead of, didn't say employ an executive director for the commission. I think this goes a little bit further. Is that your recollection as well?
Mr. Hubinger.
Mr. Chair and Representative Pepin, I'm looking at Mr. Shepard, and he's nodding, so I think you're understanding this correctly.
Representative Pepin.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hubinger, well, I guess I don't have any more questions for you. I think this is problematic. Did you get a number for how much it would cost? Did Representative Saunders? I'm wondering how much it would cost, because I remember when we worked on the Sunset Commission, I was pretty shocked at how much the appropriation would be for hiring an executive director. Perhaps you recall what that number is. I want to say it was something like $300,000-$400,000, but I can't remember exactly. Do you recall what that
Mr. Hubinger,
number was?
You can answer the question, but we're not a finance committee. This is going to taxes, and it's going to go to State Government Finance, so I think those fiscal note will be coming forward on this, and so, but you can answer the question. It's not really in the purview of this committee.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, the bill that passed in the 12th session included an appropriation to the LCC's base of $140,000 for a staff person.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Hubinger, I appreciate that. I know, and it was an executive director position, which I think would be higher. Mr. Chair, I'm wondering if you might consider, I have several questions on this bill, and I'm wondering if you might consider, if you might go over, or if you might hold this over. I guess my big concern is I wish Representative Simonson would talk a little bit about why this commission doesn't deal with increasing taxes, because this is going to raise potentially, or it's going to cost taxpayers potentially billions of dollars of increased taxes, along with all the other tax increases of Governor Dayton's proposals. And I think this is a really big issue. This is a major proposal, because we're expiring deductions that many people rely on. This has huge economic impact, and we're not looking at increased taxes or expiring taxes that we're creating, and so it seems like we're looking at only half the equation, and so I think we really need to delve in deeper. So we could vote on it today, or we could, you know, have amendments in other committees, I guess.
Representative Pepin, our purview of this committee is the setting up of the commission. The tax part of that, I believe that this is being referred to taxes, and I'm sure that they will have a full and robust discussion of that in the tax committee. And it's something that's outside the purview of our committee. It's other than setting up the commission and the rules that go around that. The tax questions you're asking are for the tax committee.
Mr. Chair, I think in the purview of our committee would be the Department of Revenue. I'm wondering, there's a report, and I'm just had some questions on that report and why some of those sections are missing. Is that in purview of this committee, or would that go to taxes as well?
Department of Revenue, as I said, and that was just reminded, is part of the State Government Finance, and as we discussed earlier, that this should go to state government finance also. So that should be discussed in there, because that's that who has the purse strings for the state government, for the Department of Revenue.
Okay.
And it doesn't substantially change what happens, their duties. Representative Pepin.
Mr. Chair, is your intention then to take a vote on this today, then?
My intention to take a vote on this today, yes.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I feel like this was rushed and that it's not quite ready to go to the next committee, but seeing as you're wanting to vote on it today, I'd like a roll call.
Roll call being requested. No further questions. Representative Quam, quickly, because we need to get out of here. We're way past our committee time.
Certainly, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to understand the purview, since we're creating the structure of this organization and staffing and the population of this organization as part of that structure, whether it's staff versus an executive director is therefore a
it's
key
in our
component.
Purview, yes.
So it's in our purview. So we would not be able to consider any of the costs of that, just the functionality, is what you're saying?
Representative Quam, we are not a finance committee. The finances piece of this will be discussed in state government finance.
Thank you, sir.
If not, we'll proceed to a vote. Mr. Gabbard, can you please state the roll?
Nelson?
Yes.
Freiberg?
Yes.
Pepin?
No.
Dill?
Yes.
Dorholt?
Yes.
Juskowski? Falk?
Yes.
Hansen?
Yes.
Kahn?
Yes.
O'Driscoll?
No.
Pugh?
No.
Quam?
Yes.
Sanders?
No.
Ward?
Yes.
Winkler?
Yes.
Nine I, five nays. The bill passes, and it's be referred to taxes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
With that, the committee is adjourned.